Okay. What is your name?
Adam Elliott.
Where do you live?
Here in Ashland.
And what's your occupation?
I work for the USDA as part of the Conservation Service.
Okay. How old are you?
I'm 41 years old.
Okay. When did you first become aware of the Starbuck Fire, hereafter referred to simply as the fire?
I'm on the fire department, so I started getting pages and iris alerts, text messages, and stuff like that about as soon as it was known to Clark County. So even as it started to occur down into Oklahoma, I was already starting to become aware of it.
So where were you, and what were your first immediate reactions?
I was actually in Dodge City at a government meeting, and I said, I've got to go. And we took off from there. It was probably around noon that day when I took off from Dodge and headed back to Clark County.
So on your way back, could you see the fire?
We could definitely see the smoke from the South Fire. What we didn't expect was that as we were coming down from Mineola, that we started to see a second fire off to the east. And we called in what became known as the north part of the fire at that point. So that was the part that we kind of expected to see the smoke to the south. But when we started to see that, we actually saw the first part of that fire starting up.
So when you returned to Ashland, did you get on a fire truck? Or
I literally got dumped off. I was riding with Heather Grigsby at the time, and she literally dumped me off at the fire station, and I jumped on a fire truck and actually didn't go south to Englewood, went north, and was the first truck to go up to the north part of the fire.
So what truck were you on?
52.
And who were you with?
I was with Delbert Wagner, who was a new firefighter at the time.
And how many gallons of water do you have on that truck, do you know?
Yeah, about 300, 350.
Okay, so where did you end up going?
Okay, we went as far north as we could. If you are familiar with the very north part of the Miller Ranch, we went up on past that and started our way across, which would be part of Giles's up in, or on the, we were on the west side of Young Brothers, and so we started across then over to the Denton Ranch where we saw the fire coming at us.
Did you catch it?
It was kind of a meet-in-the-middle kind of thing. We literally we caught into the smoke. At that point, another truck joined us up there with Francis Young, and I can't remember who was on the truck with him at that point. So we had two trucks up there, and then Rod Young showed up with a trailer with some water on it. At that point, we were in the flames of the fire as it was headed northeast, and we're trying to figure out how to get across the canyon to get to the front part of it to start to put out the flank fire, just to try and get some sort of containment on it.
So how successful were you?
We initially just were trying to get to a place where we could start to put out the fire. We quickly realized that there was, at that point, already 3 or 4 miles of fire line, and that our approximately 1,000 gallons, maybe 1,500 gallons maximum with the water tank wasn't going to get us very far. And so we started to look for what we called defensible points, anything where we could say, okay, if we can stop it at this road. And so the road that goes up past the West Tower out of town and going north is where we chose to come back to and just try and keep it from jumping that road. We were unsuccessful.
And while you were there, did the wind change?
When we were up there, we actually met up with some Mineola fire trucks who were coming down from the north side. They were actually in bloom fighting fires and had saw that this one had come up, and so they were coming. And so we were trying to defend along that road, having a little success. I won't say great success, but we had kind of prepared ourselves for it. And then we knew they were on the north side, and so we were driving back and forth through that smoke trying to stop the fire at that point. At the point where we realized we couldn't keep it at the road, we got separated. Mineola being on the north side of the fire and Ashland being on the south side of the fire. And I believe even a couple of Mineola trucks were on the south side with us too, now that I think about it. At that point, we started to recognize that conditions were changing. It had already jumped the road and it headed on east, northeast from us. and we were trying to figure out who we needed to alert. And so since I work with USDA, I had a lot of the ranchers' phone numbers, and I instantly started calling people and saying, hey, you know, we don't have this contained, and it's coming your direction. And so started calling people right then and there and say, you know, prepare yourselves for this. Don't try and fight it. Just, you know, defend your properties or do what you need to do to just make sure you're not in the way of it when it comes through. We did a little bit of firefighting to try and just keep it as contained or headed in a direction out of a couple of wheat fields up in through there. We tried to use the wheat fields to block it and keep it north out of the major rangeland to the south up there. And at that point then, the truck I was on started having fuel problems. Not sure exactly what it was. The fuel pump on that truck had worked intermittently sometimes on other fires, and so I guess it decided that we'd been running it pretty hard there for a while, and it started to act up, and so it was determined we needed to get that truck back to town so that if something happened to it, we could fix it there and get it back out. As we started to discuss sending that back to town, we took off, and there was some confusion as to where we were going, whether we were just headed back to the fire station or whether we were going to go defend properties, because at that point we started to feel the wind shift, and so we gets pretty fuzzy right after that because we started to eat a lot of smoke, and we took off then down the road to the south. At that point, the wind definitely shifted. And caught us as we were going across, coming back down from that north fire.
So were you on the back or in the cab?
I was actually in the cab at that point. Both of us were actually in the cab at that point. We were out of firefighting mode and now just in get to the next location mode. So we had both I and Delbert in the truck headed south.
So did you have any trouble breathing?
Yeah, as you look back on things, I've been on fire departments for over, I'd have to actually think, somewhere around 15 years. And so I don't remember so much at that point the breathing. You know, we were eating smoke, definitely, but it was nothing that was concerned. It was when that wind shifted and we got caught that, yeah, there was definitely a point where we were like, things are definitely difficult. And when we were coming back, the truck was sputtering and stalling. Looking back, was that because of the fuel pump or was it because of lack of oxygen? It's hard to say. I can tell you when the flames did go over us, there was definitely a feeling of, I'm not sure if I'm breathing or not right now. You know, not sure if that was shock, whether that was actual oxygen deprivation, what it truly was. But at that point, yeah, there was definitely a feeling of, oh my gosh, it's just hard to breathe. Whether again, not sure looking back on it what it actually was. But
so did you come all the way back to town?
We ended up making it back to town. The truck gave us some problems, but we ended up all the way back into town, and we left that truck at the fire station, and I called and said that, hey, you know, this truck is not running. We barely got it there, and then couldn't get it restarted. It ended up sitting on the west side of the fire station. At that point, we were getting reports from everywhere. The radio was literally off the wall with chatter, because we had people, firefighters in the north, down in the south yet. And when the wind shifted, you know, it all broke loose, I guess, at that point. And so I jumped on to, the 53, which is not normally a grass fighting truck. It's reserved. It's our emergency response extraction vehicle. We go out on wrecks and stuff like that, but it does have 600 or so gallons of water on it, and it's got a good pump and everything, and so we can use it for structure fires. We quickly just kind of converted it over to a brush rig, if you want to, by setting up, taking loose some of the long lines that we would normally fight structures with and shortening them down so we could fight right off of the truck. By that point, we were trying to go north of town to get to structures. We tried to get to Young's. We were unsuccessful getting to there. The smoke and flames got too thick before we could get to that one. And so we mainly fought then the rest of the night on the north and east side of Ashland is where we spent the remainder of the time, I guess, from, I'm going to say somewhere about 4 o'clock to the next morning. At some point in there, we were able to say that we had it, you know, stopped on that side of town and went helped out on other parts of town. But for the next, I'm going to say, you know, good 12 hours, that was majority of my time was spent going between the firehouse for water is where we had to refill, and going out all the way up to like by Cotton Baws and on that the lake road headed up that way, and then out to the cemetery, and then on the east side of town by the park and all of that out through there.
Did you go west like Gardner's and
I was not a part of that part.
Not
nope.
up there. Did
nope.
Spares and
that Spares was about, that would have been, we didn't even quite make it as far over as that. If you know where Tony Moffitt's shed is, that would have been as far over as we were going. We knew that there were trucks fighting that part over there. And so I guess I made the decision we kind of took that on. And that was one thing that happened that night is, you know, whether we got lucky or whether we were well-trained, I don't know, but we all kind of knew where we needed to be to make things happen. And so, because at one point in the evening, we lost all radio communication. I mean, that was, the repeater went down or the tower went down. And so unless we were close enough to talk truck to truck, it was just, you know, we kind of left messages back at the fire station on where we were.
Who was on your truck?
At that point, I had jumped on, Delbert had jumped over, and he was trying to work on 52. And had jumped onto another truck. I'm not sure what he jumped onto, but Tim Miller, who was, again, new to the fire department, jumped on the truck with me, and he drove that truck as we went out to those areas. So,
okay, were you successful in saving some houses?
We were successful in some houses. I won't say we were successful in all. We were able to save what would be Regeer's out there, where Lucas Regeer lives. John Kellenberger's house, we can say that we saved those two. Later on in the day, wasn't as successful, was out on Dave Bozidon's house and lost that one. I wouldn't say that I was, we call it a successful evening, but yes, we did save, I would say, the fire from creeping back into town or coming into town on that northeast side, and then we're able to save some of those rural residences out there. Cotton Boss, I guess, would be another one out there. So
during that time, like from 4 to, say, midnight, did the wind go down?
It did to some degree, but you have to remember, you know, it's the difference between 60 miles an hour and 40 miles an hour,
yeah.
Maybe even 30 miles an hour. To say that the wind had died down was definitely not the case. To say that it had reduced its vigor, maybe. It definitely, the initial blow that went through was unbelievable to me. I mean, again, fought fires for quite a while, but when that first came through, there was just no stopping what was going on, at least by that, you know, as the sun went down and the winds came down to a level that we were used to fighting. And out here we fight a lot of fires at 30 to 40 mile an hour winds, and we understand fire behavior at that level. And so we were able to, yeah, do some things that we knew how it's going to react. We were able to, you know, prepare ourselves and say, okay, we know the fire's moving at this speed. We need to be at this residence right now, and then we'll let this fire get a little closer to this one and then put it out across through there. So
did you foam houses?
We did. We did have foam, and we did foam houses and yards in some instances to go through. Kellenberger's and Regeer's were foamed. By the time we got out to Bozidon's, that was actually the next later on that morning. He had been out there and checked it. In fact, another fire truck, I believe, had been out there and checked it, and everything was good. And then something had sparked up. And so at that point, we jumped out. We were out of foam, if I remember correctly, on our rig, and we just started spraying water. But by the time we were able to go through and hook up and get water going, we just didn't have enough pump power to put that one out. So that was a sad one. That was to do. So it's hard when the owner of the house is standing right there. You know, and he's of course worried about all his cattle outright just behind the house there, and the ones that were dead and dying out in through there. And then, you know, we're And by that point, it was starting to become daylight. I mean, they were already shooting cows, and so right out in the pasture beside it. So for that house, literally there's guns going off out in the pasture, you know, putting down the suffering animals, and then his pile of ammunition in his house is going off as we're sitting there trying to do it too. So it's kind of a funny thing when you start to hear gunshots over here and gunshots over here, and you're in the middle of it trying to put out a fire. So
did the temperature change throughout the night?
It did. It definitely cooled off some. I won't say that it was at any point that I stopped breaking a sweat. I was warm and hot all night long as we moved around, just, you know, physically moving that much and being in the gear we were in. I remember sweating all night long and being very dehydrated the next day, even though we were trying to keep hydrated. Have fun. We'll see you at home.
So when you went back to the firehouse to fill up with water and throughout the night, did you run into other firefighters and hear where they were or what was going on?
Kind of a general gist. I had went through earlier in the evening, or actually that afternoon, when they were talking about evacuating, right before they talked about evacuating Ashland, I had talked to my wife and said, you know, I know where this fire is to the south, and I know where this fire is to the north. I want you to grab some of our belongings and get to the fire station. And so my family, actually, most of my family, my daughter was actually at my oldest daughter, Elida, was at a Scholars Bowl meet, and so she wasn't in Ashland. And so my two other kids and my wife went down to the fire station, and so all night long, I was one of the fortunate ones, I guess, to know that at least my family was safe, or most of my family was safe, and assumed that my oldest daughter was safe because she was well away from the fire. And so I talked to them throughout the night, and so my wife actually gave me updates on people she'd talked to as they came into the fire department or into the fire station, some of the radio chatter she had heard from the police department and stuff like that over the radios there in the fire station. So for the most part, though, I won't say that I was too in tune to what was going on truly throughout the fire. I kind of had an understanding of what was going on through the Ashland station, but what Mineola was up against or any of the Oklahoma crews or anything like that, we didn't truly know how big it was at that point. We knew that it was extensive, huge. but yeah, we didn't know how big at that point.
So you're mainly staying on the north and the east of town.
Yep, because of the timing of me getting back and just where I was and everything, that's the area that I stayed in. So
were you there when the sun came up, still in that part, or had you switched?
Yes, no, I was still on that northeast part of town and was kind of widening my range as we felt comfortable with parts of it that were truly out and that we had created a safe buffer, if you will, against the fire in town. We started to widen out, went a little bit further south, more towards Carolyn Degnan's house, and then over, like I said, over towards both Zidens when we saw that we were having some problems there. But that's mainly the area that I was in during most of the fire. So
did you take a break sometime Tuesday?
Tuesday, okay, you have to remember it all
7th.
Blends together,
yeah,
of course.
I know.
March 7th. No, as far as I remember, fires there. I did take some time to go into my work there at USDA and just put out some quick emails to let them know the office was secure and that I was going to start doing damage assessments at that point. And then I did check in with what was starting to become the Incident Command Center with Millie there and just let her know, you know, where I was and what was going on that way. So, no, I won't say that I took a break on Tuesday. Went from that, and then we started doing the spot fires going out and about throughout the county, kind of started spreading that out, and was still mainly east. I didn't actually ever go over to the west. I focused more on the east side, and so went as far down as Frank York's house and down in that area. Made it all the way actually down to the Bezidens, all the way down on the creek down there, the rivers down there. Didn't make it as far as Snake Creek. The bridge or there was probably about as far south as I went. But fought fires there at all of those. Was there at Frank York's when the flames pushed through it. There was kind of, you know, flames throughout the day where the wind would shift a little bit and the wind would pick up and it'd catch a new chunk of grass and we'd have a head fire coming through there. So
when did the first help, besides cold water, come that you're aware of? that you had.
I never even actually saw cold water where I was at. The cold water wasn't even there. So it was noon the next day when I remember saying, hey, somebody else is here. And that's the first time that I really remember saying, okay, somebody else is here. Past that, no, I can't say that we had a whole lot. And that was just a couple of trucks that I remember. It wasn't until later that afternoon and evening that we really started to see what I would call, you know, reinforcements or people there to truly start to contain or control fire.
So did you get any meals on Tuesday?
Throughout the night, my wife made sure that I had snacks and water and everything like that. Boy, I don't remember. We ate something.
Did you get the breakfast burritos that they brought from McDonald's?
No, I don't remember seeing any of those,
I guess. Did you get any hamburgers that United Wireless cooked?
I don't remember seeing any of those either. And again, because at some point we were pretty much just out in the countryside.
Nobody brought you food?
Yeah, we didn't. And maybe didn't even know where we were at, to tell you the truth. You know, it was we were kind of just, we were still in chaos mode or crisis mode at that point. And so it was literally, you know, a landowner saying, it's coming up on my farmstead, get me somebody here. And so we would feel like, you know, I won't say contained, but at least feel like we had stopped it from hitting one place, and we would jump over to the next place and defend there for a little bit until we were told to move somewhere else.
Are you mostly using water, or are you still using some foam?
At that point, I switched trucks again. That morning, after we had pretty well secured Ashland, I jumped on a truck, probably 54 or 56, but one of the five tons, with Jeremy. And,
it would have been 54 because 56
wasn't in service yet.
It was, and it went out.
Yeah, I was actually on old 56 for a little bit that night with Dave, not with Dave, with...
probably Don White, maybe?
No.
JD?
No. Why can't I think of his name? Live in protection. His wife's on the fire department, too. Name's escaping me right now.
Dan Pierce?
Yes, Dan Pierce. I was actually on old 56 for a while with Dan Pierce. Whoever was with him had jumped off for a little bit. And so we, at some point in the evening, I can't tell you when it was, when it was still dark, had jumped over on the west side with him while 53 was filling up. Went out with him on 56 because the flame was coming in on the hospital. And so we jumped out on that and took care of that, and then a little bit on the south side of town where flames were coming in. And so yeah, I'd kind of forgotten about that part, I guess.
Did you get to help put out the utility poles that brings in the electricity to town out there on the dump road?
Nope, didn't get out on any of that. That was already pretty well taken care of. So
when did your radio contact come back better again? Was it Tuesday or was it Wednesday before they got the radios back up?
I can't honestly tell you at what point we did get radios. We were still communicating. Some of the trucks, like 53, did have the 800 radios. And so we still had some incoming traffic, if you will, word coming in off of that. But we didn't get on that to really call out or do anything with that. We were basically just listening on it when we were on 53. And again, that was just between, you know, as we were driving back, you know, when we were in active firefighting mode, it's kind of hard to tell what's going on. But so we did have some communication there on that radio. On 56, or 54, I don't remember at what point we really were able to start contacting back. I know we were using cell phones some, but even that was hard to do. I mean, busy circuits and different things like that, and just different parts of the county that we couldn't receive service in. Sorry, that part is a little fuzzy when exactly that all came back.
So did you get some downtime on Tuesday? Did you get to go home, go to bed?
No, I don't think I did. So I was pretty much on a truck most of Tuesday. And so I would say that it was probably that evening when I finally went through and said, you know, things are, you know, some trucks were showing up from other places, some different things like that. So on Tuesday night, I went into work. After I got off the fires and everything like that, if I remember correctly, I went home and got cleaned up. And then went in and started emailing out and letting people know what was going on. and started to just start to report some of the damage that I'd been seeing and how widespread and what kind of damage I was seeing. And so didn't sleep Tuesday night either, if I remember correctly. Was still very well adrenalined up and didn't sleep Tuesday night. So then Wednesday morning went back to work. And at that point, whether it was a good decision or not, basically loaded up a bunch of provisions in the back of my Suburban and headed off to the ranches that I knew. One was part of just my job to do assessment to see whether we needed what kind of help was going to be needed, what kind of damage was out there. Was collecting, you know, trying to get a good handle on how many animals had died was part of what I did. And that was part of went to the incident command at some point and said, you know, hey, I'm going to be out. Is there anything you need? And so I was kind of tasked with that and trying to figure that out. And so I had a lot of people calling me in with the number of deads and different things like that. And so headed out north where I knew there was some mass casualty on the animals and was really trying to assess whether we needed to bring in major equipment for burying them and doing, you know, incinerations or anything like that and determining if it was a true mass casualty event or not. Determined it wasn't. But still saw a lot of dead cows, and I took my family with me. And so to this day, my four-year-old son still remembers and talks about the dead cows, and it was definitely a memorable day. And above and beyond that, it was memorable just because of all the people we knew out there and to see what they were going through. And really at that point, people were starting to come back to, you know, to recognize that they were human. But it was still a very shocking event. You know, I remember there was at one point where I did have to load my family up because we were out up by Giles's on the young brother, and Wildlife and Parks was out there with their rifles, and as fast as they could load them up when they were dropping cows and shooting whatever they could. And so, you know, that was kind of a tough thing to see, you know, to see a bunch of baby calves, to see a bunch of cows, you know, and just try to figure out what they were going to do from there. So
were you involved in the burying too, the categorizing and all that?
Nope, that was mainly on the veterinarians. They were out there to say, you know, to identify, if you will, the dead ones and to figure out what they needed to do with them. For the most part, after that, I became tied up a lot with just reporting what was going on out there. And started to work on recovery efforts to really go through and say, okay, what do we need in here and where do we need it at? And so with that, I spent a lot of time on a phone and behind a computer for that next, I'm going to say, when I came back in late Wednesday, I spent the rest of that day and evening at work just going through and saying, this is what needs to be done. And then Thursday was pretty much the same, out just doing assessments, trying to figure out how many houses, how many agricultural buildings, how much damage there truly was out there, and then reporting that night. And so that was my the rest of that week was pretty much that same routine. Then so somewhere in between there, did get out and just help some of my friends with some of their stuff. I won't say that it was a whole lot of help, but
who did you send the reports to?
Most of that went up through the Conservation Service, through just my chain of command, and so that's where most of that went up through. Was working directly with Farm Service Agency, FSA, to get them reports on damage, too. So,
to do stuff like the fences?
Miles of fence pastures. Damaged, number of outbuildings damaged, number of agricultural equipment damaged, number of cattle that had been killed. Again, just trying to get some rough estimates on it.
After Tuesday, you were back to doing your job instead of being a
fireman.
Yeah,
for the most part. Yeah, I don't remember hopping back on a fire truck after Wednesday. So yeah, after Tuesday, I shifted gears and felt like, you know, by that point we had started to get enough people in, or the situation was starting to get under control, and then the better place that I needed to be was back in. And coordinating all of that stuff. So
what's your most vivid memory of the fire?
Boy, to say anything was vivid about it is kind of a misnomer. I mean, it was a pretty blurry picture throughout the whole thing. If anything, you know, I had worked a lot of natural disasters in my past, And probably, I don't know if you want to call it a memory, but the thing that stands out to me was the speed in which everything happened. Just to say that I'd never fought a fire like that, and just how conditions changed so quickly, and how, you know, we went from, you know, the fire is here to the fire is, you know, 6 miles away, and, mm-hmm. And not being able to have any control over that, and not even, you know, knowing where exactly the fire was. The speed, or how fast it expanded and everything is definitely vivid in my mind. Any fires in the future, I'm going to definitely think twice about, you know, its potential, if you will, of how far and how fast this can go. It gave me a new spectrum out there. It broadened the horizon, if you will, on how things can go, how fast things can change. So.
So probably in your line of work, you've been involved with some control burns, because you've been a fireman, you know what wildfires are like. Is there anything to compare to this fire?
Well, and I'll give a little bit more background. I used to do emergency response work for EPA. I mean, mm-hmm. I was a hazmat guy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I did even like tire fires, which were 1,000 times hotter and definitely, you know, uncontrollable. You can't put enough water on those things. And had been involved with lots of hazardous waste spills and everything like that. And so I had not been involved with something like this. To say that any of even my background could have prepared me for what was going to happen during all of that would be a lie. I mean, there was just nothing to say. You know, you can't even warn people fast enough when you've got winds like that. When you have, you know, I figured it up, that fire line up north was, you know, maybe 13 to 15 miles long when the wind shifted. I mean, a head fire of 13 to 15 miles on fuels that burn within a couple of seconds with a 60-mile-an-hour wind, those aren't conditions you even train in or even consider when we're talking about fires.
So it was going like this, and then the wind hit, and it went like this.
It literally, was just a short, narrow fire up there on the north. You know, maybe a half mile wide, but with the wind from the southwest pushing it, it had moved very quickly across the north side of the county. Mm-hmm. When that wind shifted, then it went from a very narrow fire to then you had that whole what would be a flank fire on the south became the head fire and pushed through, and that's why we had so much loss on that north side of the county. It was there was just no escape. I mean, it was a consistent wall of fire that entire way through there. So, and moving at a speed that, again, none of the rest of us had ever trained on or been involved with. So,
what was your emotional response to the fire? I think you're kind of saying it, but you know, like, you've never seen anything like this.
Well, to tell you the truth, I had a saying, and during it, and for the next several weeks, even up to 3 weeks after, I was still using, because people were like, well, how are people doing down there? How are you doing and everything? And I said, I described it as the fire drunk. And that is that, you know, whatever you are when you've had too much alcohol, it's kind of how people are acting down here and how I'm acting. And so, you know, there were people who, when they're drunk, they like to fight. And we saw lots of fights throughout town. And so some people coped with it by getting aggressive and mad. We had people who cried. Heather Grigsby, the lady I worked with, you know, and at the drop of a hat, she would cry for the next 3 weeks, you know, and everything. Other people, Cheryl Golden, who worked in the office, she was giggly and bubbly and just, you know, almost to the point of insanity. You know, when someone would mention the fire, she would laugh, you know, and so I likened it to whatever personality you were whenever you drank too much alcohol. And so imagine being drunk for 3 weeks. And so for me, I become very withdrawn. I become philosophical, if you will, even when I'm drunk. And so I think that's what I was, maybe to the point of fault, you know, that maybe I'd withdrawn and was really focused on my work and what needed to be done was the way that I coped with it. You know, I won't say I had the response of rage or the response of sadness or anything like that, but definitely the emotional response of withdrawal after it. That was how I tried to cope with it. So
who were some of the people or agencies that were most beneficial in helping?
Really, in the fire containment itself, those first 12 to 24 and even 36 hours, that fire was uncontained, and the agencies that were involved with that was really just the fire departments that came in and had people there at that point. After that 36 hours, and definitely after 48 hours, the fire was pretty much not an issue anymore. I mean, this thing was done and over with within 24 hours. Not over with, but definitely the destruction part of it. There was still parts burning in the river and some small things here and there after 36 hours. But so the most beneficial was those trucks that showed up within that first 12 to 36 hours. We didn't have very many of those, but those that did show up were definitely appreciated, and we wouldn't have saved as many things as we did if we wouldn't have had them here.
Right.
So after that, things kind of, you know, went federal, if you will, and so there were a lot of people who came in and did their part. I won't say that anyone was more important than the other. You know, they all played their little parts in it and went on with life. Quickly after that, you know, it was the recovery people, and so volunteers started to play a part. Those initial volunteers that started to help clean up a few things and start to get, you know, some of us who were working to take over other parts of our lives and say, you don't need to worry about this, we got this covered, and start to do that. So I would definitely say those groups coming in. After that, I think it really shifted to, you know, how and where's the recovery going to come from? And so, not to sound conceited, but I think our agency did start to play a big part in giving people some comfort of knowing, okay, these things are covered and going to be, you know, we can repair that way. I don't know past that. Everybody went the way that they wanted to. So I know a lot of people relied on some church groups. Other people, it was, you know, outside funding sources through electronic media. And so, you know, the help came from everywhere. If there's one lesson, that don't be so narrow-minded as to where you're going to get your help from, because you never know where somebody's going to come in to help you.
So did you have any contact with the volunteers that came, the hay and that type of stuff?
Initially, at the end of that first week, there was a group that got together to try and coordinate what the recovery was going to be. It was just kind of an ad hoc group of people. I believe it was Kendall Kay who kind of got it all together. And so I went to that initial meeting of that and kind of was tasked with the fencing supplies. That quickly turned out to be something that was of contention to some people. They didn't want me being in control is the word that they used, but they didn't want me coordinating that. They felt like my part as a federal government official would bias me, and there were some people who were very vocal and very adamant that I shouldn't be involved with that. And so nonetheless, the word was already out, my name had already been put on a bunch of websites, and so yeah, there was a lot of fencing supplies and stuff that were coming in. My main coordination was just to get them here and get them to a place where they could get those supplies out to people.
Yep.
I didn't have anything to do with, you know, whether the supplies went to this person or this person. It was just kind of get them into town and get them to either the church camp so they had a place to stay, or you know, even just directly with ranchers who, so they could meet. You know, a lot of people, one thing, a memory from this is going to be how much people want to hand it to the person that needs it. They don't want to just give it to an ambiguous, you know, agency. They don't want to give cash. They want to hand what they've got to that person that needs it. And so that is a good thing, a good feeling when it works right. It can also be some people are, quite frankly, a little picky on how they do stuff. And so people who were in need, some people wouldn't give to them because they made some judgment call on it. And so it was interesting to see that response from people, and to see the response from people who truly were in need that didn't want to take stuff initially, especially. They were just like, no, 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 no. And so just kind of interesting that way.
Did you have any involvement in helping them receive that aid? I mean, like, helping them change their attitude?
No. For the most part, like I said, I was a little withdrawn during that first three weeks. And so I really did just focus on making sure that we were getting the aid into the county. be it through federal aid, be it through volunteers who were bringing stuff in. And then, of course, you know, I've talked a lot about the professional side of stuff, but on the personal side, you know, through our church and just, you know, going out. I mean, the people who were impacted were producers I worked with every day, and a lot of them are my friends. And so it was more just making sure that they were still okay from day to day. And so, yeah, when the professional part ended, the personal part kicked in. And, and I mean, that's happened, you know, up until even... It's still happening,
still ongoing,
I would say. Yeah,
yes.
You know, at the end of the day of one job, you move over into your volunteer positions and say, okay, this is what still needs to happen with this.
So did you go take advantage of the food down at the camp or go mingle with the volunteers down there at all? Or
No. Like I said, at that point, after those first couple of days, most of my stuff was simply a lot of on the phone. I won't say that I took the as many phone calls as like Ashland Feed and Seed and some of those guys did, but basically my phone was on my ear for the next 3 weeks.
Who were you getting calls from?
Part of it was just producers in the county giving me information about what was going on. A lot of people asking questions about, you know, is help coming, what's coming in. A lot of volunteers saying, this is what we've got, where do we need to bring it to? Do you guys, what do you guys need as far as fencing supplies or hay or anything like that? And so through my contacts throughout the state, there was just a lot of people who had my phone number and started calling me right away. After that, it was, you know, making sure that we had people to staff our office. We went from, you know, just at that point there were four full-time employees if you count Heather, but she was not there because of the damage that had occurred at her place, and Cheryl was even off a little at that point. And so, you know, there was at some points just two of us in the office, and so coordinating more people to come in and help to start taking people's names on what their needs were and what kind of help we needed to get to them. So we started just doing a lot of coordination effort at that point.
So do RCD and FSA work together a lot in
conservation,
a lot of their
service?
Conservation
and FSA? What usually happens is they're the administrative and financial side of things, and we're the technical side of things. And so where some people say, oh, you know, we're about through this fire, for me, I'm still doing a lot of technical work with it. I mean, every day today was out checking out fences and looking at cover crops and tree rows that had been burnt out on how we're going to clean them up. I mean, that work is going to be ongoing for the next year. And so so most of that gets reported back to the Farm Service Agency, especially as people complete stuff. Then I give them what needs to be paid on and how much they'll get paid.
So people took advantage of the program to replace their fences?
Replace fences, tear out windbreaks that were damaged, shelter belts, repair water supplies.
And then your organization, the Conservation District, goes out and checks?
The Conservation
Service.
To make
sure?
Yeah, that meets a certain minimum specification. Whenever there's federal dollars tied to it or state dollars tied to it, people want to know they're getting what they're paying for. And so, yeah. So
do you have a lot of people helping do that?
Right now, today, there were five people who were down helping check out fences. 1 week I had seven people, and that's probably going to dwindle down as we get caught up a little bit. It'll go down to just a couple of people. But that's going to be their main task over the next, I'll say, 6 months at least. It's just going out every day and looking at the fence that's being repaired.
Are these people that are close to Clark County, or
some of them? They're agency people from Greensburg, from Pratt, from Liberal, Hugoton, Wichita, Newton. Trying to think of where else. Hutchison. Those are the main areas where people are coming from.
So has a lot of the fencing been completed?
I'm going to say we're probably at about 60%, maybe 65% at this point. So,
what about windmills? Was there a lot of damage, like to solar tanks and stuff like that? Would that
in this fire, you have anything that could burn burned. And so anywhere the ember load on this fire was unlike anything I had seen. I mean, because that fire was moving so fast that it actually, your flame would catch the grass on fire or the tree on fire, but the wind was so strong that it wouldn't just burn where it was at. It would pick up that burning material and send it flying through the air. And so anything that hit then became where that fire started. And so that's why we lost a lot of the structures and vehicles and whatever else out there, so many hedge posts. That ember load just embedded itself right into whatever was out there. And so even like the solar panels, anything plastic on them where those embers could hit and potentially catch on fire, they burned up. The fiberglass tanks, if they had a bunch of weeds around them, you know, that all burned up. A lot of our windmills had just a little wooden posts driven into the ground that they were tied to, and so when those burned off, the windmill fell over, and some windmills there were even still some wooden windmills out there, and they all burned up. And so yeah, anything that could catch an ember was a potential, it burned up. So
yeah, so what is the financial effect or the physical effect of the fire more, or is it?
I have the perspective. I mean, I worked with the natural resources or the grasses and the soils and wildlife and everything throughout the county pre-fire and knew where it was at. And I often tell people that, you know, this was not necessarily a natural disaster. It was something that happens in nature. It was definitely a ranching and farming disaster, though. I mean, it definitely impacted the infrastructure and the people out there. Nature will heal itself, and in fact, it's done a pretty good job this year. We've got a lot of the grasses have come back. The trees, you know, they're going to be a little slower coming, and in some places, you know, nature said that out here on the prairie, trees weren't supposed to be out here, and so it was kind of an event that showed you, okay, this is what nature would do if trees were out here. And so definitely a devastating event for the farmers, the ranchers, the producers, the people who lived out here. Nature will recover and be okay. And it'll take a little bit of time. There was definitely some damage when you have that intense of a flame. And then the dry period afterwards where we had so much blowing dirt and sand and ash, you know, for the 3 weeks afterwards until we got that first good rain. That did do some damage out there. And so it will take a couple of years. We'll still see those scars on the trees probably for decades out there. As you drive down the roads, if we don't cut down all those big trees, they're going to be standing for quite some time, yeah, as a reminder of this fire. So
what about shelter belts? Did we lose a lot of shelter belts?
Yeah, most of those were total losses anywhere where the head fire went through. So yeah, as you go through the Englewood area and anywhere around where those shelter belts were, yeah, they were pretty much total losses. And a lot of those trees aren't coming back either. Yeah. And so they're just going to be standing relics there for a while. So, yeah.
And bulldoze them, basically, is how they, or whatever?
A lot of those trees are so big that if you'd actually try and do it with a bulldozer, you're just going to end up with a big old tree sitting on top of you.
Yeah.
So in a lot of instances, they're having to go in with a traco or an excavator and grab the tops of those trees and break them over, and then you can bulldoze them or do something with them. But sometimes if you just hit on the bottom of them, there's so much weight and everything up in there, yeah, there's not a lot you can do. And nature's already starting to tear them down. I mean, the high winds we've had, and I'm sure with a couple of snowfall events or something like that, we'll probably start to see. They'll be falling for the next decade anyway.
So. Yeah, I bet so. Can you perceive anything positive that's resulted from the fire?
Again, from the natural side of things, fire was always a part of the prairie out here, and so there was definitely, after the drought, we started to get some rains and see some recovery, but after the initial fire, nature really took off. The wildflowers, the insects, the dare I say, the snakes and reptiles, the small mammals, were back within a couple of months and prolific, if you will. I mean, they were everywhere. And then the larger mammals and everything are coming back too. So nature is definitely going to have a positive impact from this fire. You found out who was your friends and who you could trust and who you could rely on during this. And maybe that's a positive and a negative. There was definitely some friendships lost during this. There was definitely some friendships that were set in stone over this, you know, because people were there when you needed them to be. And that might be, you know, with their hands. It might have been with their hearts. It was something where, you know, those friendships were either broken or deepened because of this whole thing, you know. it definitely puts you in a perspective of what, you know, they oftentimes play that philosophical game of, okay, you only have 10 minutes to grab what's important to you in your life out of your house. Well, it wasn't a game this time. It was, you know, what's important to you? Who are you going to call? Who are you going to make sure is safe? What is so important to you that you're going to grab it and load it up and take it away with you, because you're going to lose everything? And so that's always something. That's a mind changer for you on what's truly important in your life and what isn't, you know, and what you can lose and still be who you are and keep the things that you truly wanted to keep. So
did you take advantage of it, or did you go to any of the meetings afterwards that kind of tried to put together what happened, how it happened, what we did right, what we did wrong, or any of the ones where if you needed some counseling?
I was definitely meetinged out over this thing, because the federal government loves to have meetings. Oh. And so every time somebody new walked into town, a congressman, whatever, I was at that meeting. And I can't even tell you how many of those meetings I went to. Being on the fire department then, we had a lot of debriefings and trying to figure out what had gone on and everything, and so tried to make it to as many of those as I could. And then, did actually the Iroquois Center talk to that lady, right after the fire, to just say, you know, what are going to be the responses, just to kind of get, as I was out working with people, you know, what am I going to expect and everything like that, or what should I expect out there? And then afterwards, yeah, telling her, just kind of getting some feedback, because to me, telling her what I was seeing was kind of my way of dealing with things, you know, this is what people are doing. And so it gave me a perspective on, you know, what I needed to do in my own life, if you want to that way. So
when you went to the meetings with the congressmen and the senators and the governor that came through, what were their reactions to the fire? Did they mainly listen?
A lot of them, of course, want to be empathetic, and they want to be and say, you know, we understand, we understand. I don't know that they truly could grasp it either. I mean, to mm-hmm. walk in, I did one tour, and it's a tour that I gave for a large group of people from across, or a relative 30 people from across the state, and came down, and I started up on the very north part of the fire, and I said, you know, this is where the fire started, and we looked across to the next ridge over, and I said, you know, this whole area burned. And, you know, they're just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe how big this was. And I talked about, you know, some of the homesteads and then losing those and the number of cattle that had died, you know, from where we stood to the next ridge over. And so then we got all in our trucks and we drove, and I showed them some houses, and we get back up on that next ridge. And I said, so what you've seen now is less than a sixth of what the actual fire was. And then I have them look south from Mount Jesus is where we stop. And I have them look south at the remainder of the fire. And I will tell you, it is silence at that point, because people could barely comprehend the little piece, the sixth or the seventh or, you know, whatever little fraction of the fire that I had shown them. It was bigger than anything they could even comprehend. And only by driving through it and talking about it could they start to get a sense of scope of that area. And then when I told them the rest of this also went, it was pretty much a mind-blowing event for both of them, and they just couldn't. I mean, it took them a while, and so I would receive phone calls, I mean, still do, from people who are just like, man, when you showed us that, were you, I mean, you know, when you were talking about it, I'm just now starting to understand, you know, what had truly gone on, you know, when I showed them a cottonwood, you know, and you see flame marks, you know, 45 feet in the air on it, you know, unless you see that tree and truly understand that the flames coming through were at that height, you can't comprehend, you know, a flame or a fire that big. And so to say that they did their best to understand what was going on down here, yeah, most people when they came down here it was because they wanted to know. To say that without going through the fire that you'll ever truly understand, probably not. It's one of those experiences that only the people who were here are going to truly, and even us, we're probably, most of us were in shock during most of it anyway, so will we truly understand what was going on? Probably not, but...
Would you say one part of the county got hit worse than the other part, or was the fire just, when it went through, it just completely devastated everything that it hit?
Again, the intensity and the speed and the scale of this fire, it wasn't selective. I mean, when it pushed through, anything that was burned could burn. and even some things that we didn't think could burn, you know, steel sheds. Yeah. It found the insulation. It found the pile of wood or the hay bale that was sitting inside of it and caught it on fire. It found the whatever it could and burned down the steel sheds even. You know, there was flames inside of steel sheds. You know, stuff that you don't even anticipate burning, yep. You know, burned during this thing. So to say that one part of the county was hit harder than any other part of the county, the areas where the head fire pushed through were definitely impacted more. But to say that that is any less devastation than any other part of the county, no. I mean, when stuff burns up, it's burnt up. Yep. There's.
So you've been all over the county and seen all the devastation and stuff. What do you miss most from before to here?
The hardest part for me was probably people's homes. I mean, that's a hard thing. I mean, burning up a fence, you know, cattle, you know, those are things, you know, as you drive by and you realize that this person isn't in their house right now, one, because it's damaged or because it's not there, that's a pretty hard thing to go through and drive down through the county and say, you know, that's never going to be there again, or, you know, those people were truly impacted, you know, then thank goodness my house is still standing. But so as far as the rest of it, you know, I talk to a lot of producers and a lot of ranchers, and they're like, you know, just the landmarks of, you know, when the windmill burned up, you didn't have it to look over there to say, hey, you know, go to the windmill and that's there. The large cottonwood trees, you know, that always referenced, you know, hey, that's where this part of the pasture is, go over there and go on. And so, but for the most part, yeah, it was the people's homes as I drove around, just still those constant reminders that, you know, this is going to take a while to recover from was probably the hardest part for me. So
what can you do or have you done to prepare for another, say, disaster, whether it's a fire or whatever?
So through my job, we do actually do some prescribed burning, tree removal, stuff like that, an awareness that, you know, hey, maybe we don't want cedar trees out there, as many cedar trees, and definitely not near our houses, and to go through and, you know, help people with the fences as they build them, you know, to make something that's a little more fire resistant, to think about where they put fences and how we gain access to pastures. I know we weren't able to save a lot of grass, at least in those first days. But afterwards, you know, we still could have saved more if we could have had access to places. So, you know, just how you lay your farm and ranch out, doing that is definitely something to consider. You know, there's a disaster event like that, you can kind of have an idea of what you're going to do. You know, planning for major disasters is, if we could do it, then, you know, New Orleans probably wouldn't be there anymore. We would have moved it up and out of the way, you know. Yeah. And so there's only certain things you can do. And so, but for me, you know, it isn't so much on the agency side of things, my job every day, that I do some with that. But on the fire department side of things, really having a, like I said, a new end of the spectrum on how far things can go and how fast they can happen and what you need to do to keep yourself safe and keep everybody else safe in those situations. So
do you think the people on the fire department benefited from the training that they've done through the years?
Oh, definitely. And even in the fact, you know, of just how we fought fires, you know, and just being able, we fight a lot of fires down here, the most that I've ever been on in a fire department. We got a lot of rangeland. There's a lot of district to cover, if you will, and look at it that way. And we do a lot of mutual aid to a lot of other places. And so you're just not, you know, focused in on a little piece. We cover some ground. We go across state lines. And so the experience and the training that we had prior to this fire is probably what saved a lot of firemen's lives, if not other people's lives and properties, because we knew our equipment and how to run it. We knew, you know, how to keep ourselves safe. We knew just how we worked with each other. You know, that this truck, if this is happening, this truck's going to be here, or this truck's going to be there. Was it perfect? No. Was communication strained and did people, you know, get upset over what somebody had done? Definitely. But at the same time, you know, I look at other departments I've been on in the past, and had this happened there, I don't think they would have came through it nearly as well. That's just an opinion, of course. But I think we had some resources, and we knew how to use them. And had we had more resources, yeah, we would have done more. But to say that that we were ill prepared, yeah, we didn't have a chance against this fire. But to say that we did our best on it, and that was, again, it's what kept people safe. It's what kept damage to a minimum. I mean, people knew what they were doing out there, and so.
Yeah. So what about the community? Is there any way the community could prepare, like how our fire and emergency and police work together, or
communication about evacuating? Yeah. Of course, there's always the, we were told to evacuate, but they didn't tell us to where. So there's some things that can always be learned on that. To tell you the truth, I didn't believe it when people actually evacuated, because I've been involved, like I said, with hazardous waste response. And you'd tell people, there's an ammonia leak, you need to get out of your house, and they look at you like, well, I'm not leaving. When they sent out the word to evacuate Ashland, this town became a ghost town. I mean, there was still a few people left in town, but it was, a handful to a dozen people. It wasn't, there was 90% of this community got out right away. I mean, there was imminent danger here, the evacuation notice, should we have sheltered everybody in place? That's the only other option you have. You either get everybody completely out of harm's way, or you shelter them in place. That's for someone in emergency management to decide. Would we have been safer just sending everybody to the high school and calling that our defensible point? The high school has a whole bunch of cedar trees around it and a whole bunch of grass on it, and the wind was out of the north at that point, and so all of that would have been hitting the high school. Had we had everybody there and lost the high school, I don't want that on. I wouldn't have wanted to have to make that call. And so there are some things there, just in communication that can be improved. Would anybody else have responded any differently in that situation? Probably not. So, the 911 operators probably had the worst job of going through, and when people called in and just saying, we have no one available to get to you. I wouldn't have wanted that. Fighting fire was bad enough, but to tell someone on the other end of the line that, they're saying they need help, and you have to tell them, there's no one to help right now. We'll try it, we're 20 minutes away, and that's only if we can find someone to get out there. I wouldn't have wanted that job. And so something this wide scale, you can't prepare for. It's something that we did what we could with the resources we had, and hope to gosh we don't have to deal with it again.
That's true. So do you have any other thoughts about this experience? Anything else you'd like to share?
No. Not really. I think we've pretty well covered it. I mean, it was an event, so our lives go on now. I mean, it'll be something that impacts this generation, my generation, the younger generation that had to go through it. And
have your kids talked about it?
Oh yeah. Again, I went through and loaded my kids up that day after the fire. After I hopped off the fire trucks, we jumped into our big old green Suburban and loaded it up with supplies, and we went out. And they were very much in the devastation. I mean, they saw the dead animals. They saw the ranchers, and people out there with blackened faces, except for where their tears had ran down their faces, I mean, they were a part of all of that. And so they were, again, my family was in town. And my wife, will tell you, she looked around and said, there's no way we're saving Ashland, because there were flames all the way around it. Those kids... they're resilient, thank goodness, but they were definitely a part of it. They're going to remember it, and it'll be a part of their life, I have a feeling. So
did they go home during the night? I mean, or did they stay at the firehouse?
They stayed at the firehouse all that first night. I didn't feel safe letting them go back home. Yeah. I mean, that entire night we were still just trying to save Ashland from burning up, because we'd seen what happened in Englewood, where it went from house to house to house. I mean, we knew the potential of this fire, and so we knew if it got into Ashland, one house fire to the next house fire, we didn't have any resources to stop that.
Yeah.
So,
anything else?
Not that I can think of.
Okay. Thank you for sharing your experience with us.
Not a problem at all. I hope this turns out well, that you get some things put down and can share it with whomever wants to learn about it. So.
Yeah, me too. Yep. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for doing it.